Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never, as I went into nothing but a diatribe yesterday about how there is no chance in Hades that we're going to see our government willingly relinquish the powers they have usurped from your states, from your counties, and from you, the people. Sorry, folks. I'm not here to give you good news. I'm here to tell you exactly what is going on and what is constitutional, what isn't constitutional. One of the things I kind of started going into, but I had to kind of rush, because it's all about the application of money. I want you to understand that the application of money to government is the same as to grassroots movements. So when government needs money, they actually have the ability to tax you. The grassroots movements cannot tax you to do what really needs to be done. The problem is the grassroots movement that you're contributing to really going into a comprehensive fix? Or have they completely bamboozled you into believing that fixing this one problem solves everything? I saw a social media post where this gentleman was posting something about some online software concept of creating a voting system that could not be corrupted. He's asserting that this one thing solves all of our problems. Well, maybe what he meant to say was it solves our election problem, but I doubt it. So our election problem isn't making sure that we force and compel everybody to take interest or involvement in our government. There are people that want to be inhabitants in America. I know. I worked with people that did not want to be registered voters because they didn't even want to participate in the jury duty status. Now, that's sad, but as far as I'm concerned, we need to start marking and differentiating and distinguishing between U.S. citizens and people who are inhabitants, because there are good people that live here that they don't care. They really just don't care. And it's hard for me to fathom this. As a matter of fact, one guy I knew, he was a submariner. I mean, so in other words, he did 20 years in the Navy and you know, he did his part supposedly as a U.S. citizen, but to avoid having to do jury duty, he just said, you know, not for me. I'm not going to register to vote. And then he wanted to complain all the time and basically make snide comments and so forth. And as far as I'm concerned, you don't get a chance to complain. If you're not getting yourself involved and contributing to the solution by contributing as an elector, by, you know, a part of the electorate, then you need to actually, you know, just shut up. Now, he has a right to complain and so forth, but let's remember that the rights really only apply to a U.S. citizen. And one of the things that they actually did in the very beginning of this nation was they pounded out what the difference between a citizen and an inhabitant was. You could be a citizen of the state, but you're not a U.S. citizen because you're not participating in all the other aspects. And there was no need for you to participate. You were basically, in a way, if you traveled abroad, then you would have been a U.S. citizen because at that point in time, the federal government would have had jurisdiction over you if you were called out on crimes against laws of nations or was basically had Trump charges on crimes committed on the high seas. So there was this blanketed protection for all people. And they called that a U.S. citizen, but I honestly think a U.S. citizen has a much higher bar. And I believe that bar is that person actually has to be somebody that is willing to participate and get engaged and actually, you know, vote. But more importantly, I truly believe that we also have this requirement, this obligation to supporting the Constitution. Now, what do we do with a nation if all of a sudden we don't have enough people to support the Constitution? In other words, if we had to actually start deploying the militia and we found out that we had 50% of the people conscientious objectors, what do we do? Well, that's a tough question. I leave it to you to think about. I want you to cogitate about this. Are we willing to actually surrender? Or are we willing, because just remember, when we were facing the tyranny of Britain, what was the percentage of people that rose up to protect the liberties of all individuals? And then everybody was pretty thankful afterwards, especially when the war came to, you know, to their hometown. The war, you know, rolled right by them, did all sorts of damage and so forth. The fact is, it is just, it's hard to accept that we as a nation have gotten to a point where we're willing to have another war here. We're willing to, people are, they don't care enough to be able to do what is necessary to preserve to our posterity both liberty and tranquil peace. There are lots of things that require, that we have to do that requires, you know, the respect of other nations so that we can enjoy peace. And we're not even doing any of the stuff we're supposed to be doing. Anyway, I digress. Here's the irony. And I can't emphasize this enough because in the last show, I kind of plugged as I was closing out the show that you all needed to contribute. We need to change the paradigm. This contribution cannot just be by the investments of persons. It must also include businesses. We have a lot of small businesses that have to start understanding that if they want to be able to be in business, if they do not want government tyranny to control, they're already facing government tyranny and they don't even understand it. So we need to start waking up and getting businesses and people, small businesses, medium businesses, even large businesses, if they love the Constitution and they love the concepts of liberty and individual sovereignty, then they need to start contributing, period. All right, so as I promised you, we were going to get into the Whiskey Rebellion. So we are going to get into the Whiskey Rebellion, but I've got one more obligatory. You are listening to the only show that gives you the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions, and this show is also sponsored by republicreview.org. As we get into the Whiskey Rebellion, I want you to understand, you know, I'm gonna read something I did, and I created this a while ago, and this is actually, you know, a good overview of the Whiskey Rebellion and what kind of set the stage, because the Whiskey Rebellion was a 1794 uprising of farmers and distillers in western Pennsylvania in protest of a whiskey tax, If I said tact, you heard tact. I might have said it. Anyway, a whiskey tax enacted by the federal government. Following years of aggression with tax collectors, the region finally exploded into a confrontation that resulted in President Washington sending troops to quell the, you know, the somewhat feared, what could have been even blown up into a revolution type of situation. Opposition to the whiskey tax and the rebellion itself built support for the Republicans, who finally and fully overtook the Federalist Party for power in 1802. Now, I've told you. We're gonna get into this with the resolutions of 1798. Sorry, because I'm going down a different topic. We're gonna dive into really kind of what happened in the political scheme of America when we get into the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798, what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison did. These men stood up as leaders and basically said, this is not constitutional. We need to get the government back into the framework of the Constitution, just like what we're doing. Just like what we're doing with Reclaiming the Republic, with Republic Review, the federal review committees at the state level, federal, or I should say constitutional compliance down at the county level and state level, and so forth. The Whiskey Rebellion is considered one of the first major tests of the authority of the newly formed government. As I've been telling you, that individual states incurred significant debt from the Revolutionary War. In 1790, Alexander Hamilton, we just covered this, pushed for the federal government overtaking, or the Assumption Act, and overtaking the debt of these states. He also suggested an excise tax on whiskey to prevent further financial difficulty. In other words, well, shoot, now that we collected these debts, now we could start flexing our arms and say, we need this money to pay these debts. See, the whiskey tax may not have actually been supported because they go, well, you know, how much? Because they could have projected what their estimates would have been on revenue. Why would they need that kind of revenue if they're not going to war or anything else? Ah, but see, by assuming the debt, as noble as that was, now we had a cause to actually start taxing the people. Do you understand? You know, spending and then taxation. That's how it works, and that's how even Wilson played this when he was doing in the progressive era. You know, hey, we need to insert this amendment for the individual income tax, the 16th Amendment. That's exactly what happened. Anyway, we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL. Or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so as I was going into break, I was really just trying to help connect the dots that when the government all of a sudden assumed all of this expenditures, now let's look at today's present situation. Biden has been basically spending, what, from the vaccinations and all of these other things, from the Build Back Better and the supposedly, It's supposedly to reduce and fight inflation. This last thing he did, that's going, he hired 86,000. I mean, in other words, he's spending more money, but it baked into this plan is tyranny to basically get their pound of flesh out of you and I. So in other words, they spend, and then they go, okay, now we got to do something drastic to get money. Hamilton did the exact same thing. He laid down the formula of how to be able to start flexing government muscle by assuming this debt. So once he did that, President George Washington, who was opposed to Hamilton's suggestion of a whiskey tax in 1791, until Washington journeyed through both Virginia and Pennsylvania to speak with citizens about their views. Now, the question was, did he get a good enough sampling of the citizens? Local government officials met the idea of a whiskey tax with enthusiasm. Notice local government officials. I'm not sure that the people were really happy to actually have to pay something in a tax. So Washington took his assurance back to Congress, which then passed the bill. But protests against this new tax began immediately, arguing that the tax was unfair to small producers. Under the new law, there were these kickbacks, or what we called tax breaks. Large producers paid the annual tax at a rate of six cents per gallon. In other words, it wasn't an even tax across the board. And the more they produced, the further the tax breaks would come. In other words, if they produced a lot more whiskey, then it may go down to 5 cents a gallon, or 2-3 cents, 2 cents, whatever. Anyway, the whole point was that small producers were stuck with paying a full 9 cents per gallon because they were incapable of producing more. Who do you think was hurt the most? Thank you very much, because they now had to sell whiskey at a cheaper cost to include for the cost of the tax. Now they couldn't compete with the bigger producers. In other words, this was a perfect ploy of laying down the foundation of giving an advantage to bigger producers instead of having a, you know, even playing field that everybody paid the fair share. Creating tax breaks for, you know, bigger producers or those who are capable of doing more is unacceptable. It is not a uniform application. Remember, the uniform clause requires that the federal government uniformly apply this across the states. So, again, protests basically actually began, and this is what we had to start looking at. And there was all of these undercurrents in Washington, D.C. on what are they going to do because of these immediate protests. Well, they maybe, you know, well, give it some time, let the people settle into this, right? Well, the law was immediately this failure because of these refusals, and what was becoming common was intimidation against those officials hired to collect the taxes. Excise officers sent to collect taxes were met with defiance and threats of violence. Violence first broke out on September 11th, 1791. Excise officer Robert Johnson was riding through his collection route in western Pennsylvania when he was surrounded by 9 men dressed as women. The mob stripped him naked and then tarred and feathered him before stealing his horse and abandoning him in the forest. Now, they didn't kill him, but tar and feathering, but that is a, that's a cruel punishment. That is uncalled for, right? Johnson recognized 2 of the men in the mob. He made a complaint and warrants were issued for the arrest. A cattle drover named John Connor was sent with the warrants, and he suffered the same fate as Johnson. He was tied to a tree in the woods for 5 hours before being found. In response, Johnson resigned his post, fearing further violence. Incidents escalated over the next few years. Now, I want you to think about this. here was the government that was actually trying to do something, and the people were protesting. Now, look at the difference. They're saying we're not abiding by this law, and when government came into them, they basically protested against government. And what they should have done was they should have been using First Amendment petitions to basically, and this doesn't get into whether there were First Amendment petitions or not. And I would love to find a historian that could go through and determine whether Pennsylvania was lighting up all over the place with First Amendment petitions. Because by 1791, 1792, we do know that the First Amendment petition was reenacted as a right under this new form of government by the Bill of Rights. That's when it was ratified. And so what we want to do is I'd like to actually see, you know, if people actually exercise their constitutional rights, or if they thought that they, you know, they just needed to fight back, because at the previous years, that's what they did against Britain. That's what they did, you know, to actually, you know, cast off a taxation government. Well, anyway, incidents escalated over the next few years, and in 1793, the home of Pennsylvania excise officer Benjamin Wells was broken into twice. The first time, a mob of people forced their way in and assaulted Wells' wife and children. The second incident involved six men in disguises who attacked Wells while he was at home. The intruders demanded that Wells account books at gunpoint and insisted he resign his position. So in other words, give us your records on the taxation, who's paying, and so forth, because they didn't have copies back then. They didn't have it on a file or USB drive. It was all in this one little ledger. So they felt that if they destroyed that, then he couldn't, you know, identify how much was produced already and how much owed taxes and all of that stuff. So feeling unrepresented in Congress, the citizens of West Pennsylvania gathered their own assembly with 3 to 5 representatives per county, while radical members pushed for open rebellion. Moderates like Hugh Henry Brackenridge and future Secretary of the U.S. Treasury Albert Gallatin urged conciliatory measures. In the summer of 1794, Federal Marshal David Lennox began the process of serving taxation writs, to 60 distillers in western Pennsylvania who had not paid the tax. On July 14th, and actually these were writs probably for arrest or what have you, but anyway, on July 14th, Lennox accepted services of tax collector and wealthy landowner John Neville as guide through the Allegheny County. The attack on John Neville's home in Bower Hill occurred on July 15th, that same year. They approached the home of William Miller, who refused to accept his summons. An argument ensued, and when Lennox and Neville rode off, they were face-to-face with an angry mob armed with pitchforks and muskets. Someone had told the mob that the federal agents were dragging people away, but Lennox and Neville were allowed to pass once that was understood untrue. Nonetheless, a shot was fired as the two men rode away. On the morning of July 16th, Neville was asleep in his home, Bower Hill, when he was awakened by a crowd of angry men, some of whom had been served summonses the previous day. The men claimed that Lennox needed to come with them because there was a threat to his life. Neville didn't believe the men and ordered them off his property. When the mob refused to move, Neville grabbed a gun and shot at the crowd, striking and killing Oliver Miller. Now, so first casualty was a protester. In retaliation, the mob shot back at the house. Neville made it inside the house and sounded a signal horn, after which he heard the sound of his slaves attacking with firearms. Six of the members of the mob were wounded before they fled with Miller's body. By evening, the mob had reconvened for a meeting with a group of other people who declared revenge on Neville. the destruction of Bower Hill, which was basically just a couple, the next day, actually, on July 17, 1794, as many as 700 men marched to Drums and gathered at Neville's home. They demanded his surrender, but Major James Kirkpatrick, one of the 10 soldiers who had come to the property to help defend it, answered that Neville was not there. In fact, Kirkpatrick had helped Neville escape the house and hid in a ravine. The mob demanded that the soldiers surrender. When that request was refused, they set fire to the barn and slave dwellings. The Neville women were allowed to flee to safety, after which the mob opened fire on the house. Following an hour of gunfighting, the mob's leader, James McFarland, was killed in a rage of mobs to set fire to the other buildings, and the soldiers soon surrendered as the Bower Hill estate burned to the ground. So now we had our second casualty. Now, while I'm reading this, while I'm going through this for you, I hope you're thinking about what happened in 2020. You know, these protests on the street, all the innocent people that were absolutely harmed because of their race. Anyway, we'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org. And go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I hope you're placing context to how this protest was very specific about a whiskey tax, that people were coming to them and saying, you got to pay this tax, or we're summoning you to basically stand trial for failing to pay your tax. It's kind of like, you know, all of a sudden the police started, instead of, you know, you paying these tickets, now they have to summon you to court. Well, if everybody uprose against, you know, the police tickets for these traffic citations and started getting hostile with government and attacking government, well, see, they actually created a law and a system that made it illegal, wrong for you to resort to violence. That the process was to debate, and the concept was, rightfully, you know, right or wrong, the concept was at that point in time to be debated, you know, with government itself so that they could fix the wrong. The problem here is, folks, is that they actually had the ability to set this excise tax that was within the constitutional boundaries. In other words, the federal government wasn't, they may not have liked it. And what they may need to do is they may need to go down this path of saying, hey, look, you know, we're going to have to, you know, elect people to, you know, undo this type of crap. But it was well within the bounds of government. And so they still protested, right? And so what was going on in 2020 was not a protest per se against the Constitution. It was a constitutional government. It was a protest demanding government become more unconstitutional. And government actually allowed them and basically set aside the Constitution and created autonomous zones, whether that be the city of Seattle, whether that be Portland, or any of these other places that set up autonomous zones. Folks, what the heck happened? Constitutional ignorance is killing us. That's one of the biggest takeaways we need to understand. We need to understand the Constitution. This is not rocket science. Can they do it? If they can, then it's legitimate government. But the fact is that the majority of what they're doing is illegitimate because they don't have the authority to do it. This is what we keep on pounding and pounding. And most of you are getting this. And this right here, folks, is the message we have to start actually driving into the brain housing groups of your like-minded friends. They need to start getting this message, and they need to get on board with reclaiming the Republic, because we can't do it without you, and we can't do it without them. So anyway, the threat to Pittsburgh. So less than a week later, the mob met with local dignitaries who warned that Washington would send a militia to strike them down, in the pending days, weeks to come. Wealthy landowner David Bradford, along with several other men, attacked a mail carrier and discovered three letters from Pittsburgh expressing disapproval on the attack on Neville's property. Bradford used these letters as an excuse to encourage an attack on Pittsburgh, inciting 7,000 men. 7,000! Back in those days, that was a high percentage of people that actually was taking a stand in fighting a constitutional act of government. And in contrast to the Bolshevik Revolution we were seeing today or recently in the streets of America, from coast to coast. Anyway, the city of Pittsburgh, fearing violence, sent a delegation to announce that the three-letter writers had been expelled from the city and to offer a gift of several barrels of whiskey. Ah, we're going to, you know, here you go. We're giving you this whiskey. Please don't attack us. As the day ended, the crowd had drunk deeply from the barrels and weren't inspired to descend on Pittsburgh with any fury, instead gaining permission to march through Pittsburgh peacefully. Washington sends the militia as promised, with signs that the rebels were hoping to reignite the conflict and believing it was linked to unrest in other parts of the country. Hamilton wanted to send troops to Pennsylvania, but Washington opted for a peace envoy instead. The peace envoy failed. Washington met with his cabinet officials and presented evidence of the violence to the Supreme Court James Wilson from Pennsylvania himself, who ruled a military response was justified under the auspices of the Militia Acts of 1792. So we got to look up those Militia Acts of 1792. And what you'll find is the Militia Act, Congress actually violated the Constitution by giving Washington full discretion to be able to call forth a militia. I mean, who are they to challenge Washington, the mighty man who freed us from Britain, you know, and his honor and his integrity? The Constitution requires that Congress call forth the militia. In other words, them giving him this full capability whenever he wanted to call forth the militia was not constitutional. Washington assumed emergency power to assemble more than 12,000 men from the surrounding states and eastern Pennsylvania as a federal militia. And so if we go down this path, let me take this aside. In Section 8 of the Constitution, the power to call forth a militia was expressly given to Congress, but only 2 years into George Washington's presidency, the Second Congress temporarily delegated its authority under the First Militia Clause by passing a statute, basically, quote, to provide forth calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. The Militia Act of 1792 was meant to be a three-year-long experiment, but gave the president broad powers to call out the militia. Section 1 of the Act covered foreign invasions and imminent dangers from a foreign nation and met with little resistance in Congress. On the other hand, Section 2, which dealt with the suppressing insurrection, met with much resistance on the floor of Congress. After much debate, additional amendments were added requiring judicial intervention and that the president must first order the insurgents to disperse. 2 years after this act passed, President Washington called forth the militia to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion. In Washington's sixth State of the Union, he recounted the actions that he took. First, Washington followed the Constitution and the Militia Act by first seeking and receiving certification from the Supreme Court. Quote, upon testimony of these facts, an associate, Justice, which was Wilson, from the Supreme Court of the United States, notified to me that, quote, in the counties of Washington and Allegheny in Pennsylvania, laws of the United States were opposed and the execution thereof obstructed by combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings or by the powers vested in the marshal of that district. Second, Washington's issued a proclamation commanding the insurgents to disperse. Third, quote, I postponed, therefore, the summoning of the militia immediately into the field, but I required them to be held in readiness that if my anxious endeavors to reclaim the deluded and convincing the malignant of their danger should be fruitless, military force would be prepared to act before the season should be too far to advance. My proclamation of the 7th of August last, 1794, August 7th, was accordingly issued and accompanied by the appointment of commissioners who were charged to repair to the scene of the insurrection. Finally, the president assembles the militia to quell the rebellion. Quote, thus the painful alternative could not be discarded. I ordered the militia to march after once were admonishing the insurgents in my proclamation of the 25th of the September last. Washington was distraught that the military force had been used against his own countrymen, but he was very happy to report that the rebellion was over. The event itself was disgraceful and required a significant portion of the country's resources, but it proved that our prosperity rested on a solid foundation of citizens who understood the true principles of liberty. I'll even add further that it depended more upon people who were willing to stand and defend the Constitution. We cannot allow people, just because it's inconvenient, that they, you know, stand up and say, hey, there were problems with this. Clearly there were problems. And it should have been challenged in court that the whiskey tax was unfair because it gave advantages to the large distillers, period. And that in itself should not have been permissible. I can't understand how they allowed this, what we call a progressive tax, because it opened the door for years later progressive taxation to be applied. So to be clear here, folks, when we look at, you know, all these things considered, there was merit in basically calling out government, but unfortunately, we're not seeing any witnessing of that. That's why I said I'd love to see somebody actually have, who has the time to research whether there were First Amendment petitions in the state of Pennsylvania, in these counties, you know, pleading to their state legislature and so forth to please, you know, make and abide by the Constitution and the Uniformity Clause to ensure that there's no advantage given to certain producers over other producers, period. It was unfair that they did this. So anyway, we'll be right back with the rest of the Whiskey Rebellion after these two promos. Thank you so much.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and their 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
So here's what Washington said. Quote, "While there is cause to lament that occurrences of this nature should have disgraced the name or interrupted the tranquility of any part of our community or should have diverted to a new application any portion of the public resources, there are not wanting real and substantial consolations for the misfortune. It is demonstrated that our prosperity rests on solid foundations by furnishing an additional that my fellow citizens understand the true principles." Again, I'll just re-repeat that. By furnishing an additional that my fellow citizens, so I don't know if this was written right, but this is the citation, of government and liberty, that they feel their inseparable union, that notwithstanding all of the devices which have been used to sway them from their interest and duty, they are not as ready to maintain the authority of the laws against licentiousness, invasions, as they were to defend their rights against usurpations. Commander-in-Chief George Washington could not have been prouder of the militiamen that he called forth and marched 300 miles to Pennsylvania. Quote, "It has been a spectacle displaying of the highest advantage of a Republican government to behold the most and the least wealthy of our citizens standing in the same ranks as private soldiers, preeminently distinguished by being the army of the Constitution, undeterred by a march of over 300 miles, rugged mountains, by approach of inclement season, or by any other discouragement." Washington was also proud and wanted to thank the patriotic support he received from the governors. Quote, "Nor ought I to omit to acknowledge the efficacious and patriotic cooperation which I've experienced from the chief magistrates of the states to which my requisitions have been addressed. Now, so here's an interesting thing. He used the word magistrates when the governors really weren't magistrates at all. Under this new form of government, we didn't have magistrates anymore. And so, because we created a separations of powers. Magistrates was an old paradigm, and unfortunately, that concept has, you know, kind of commingled during this new constitutional government that some of the, I'll call them old guard people that lived under Britain, like Washington, even Jefferson and some of these others, didn't grasp, and they still clung to the vernacular of a monarchy under this new hybrid constitutional republic. So when people see these types of words, they kind of go, oh, magistrates actually, see, he called these guys magistrates. So obviously they existed, but actually, no, they didn't. Their power was stripped of a full magistrate. They couldn't make the laws and enforce the laws and judge the laws anymore. A full magistrate, as we talk about, is a full sovereign, just like the King of England was the chief magistrate of the land. He made the laws and he enforced the laws. And he basically was the judge and jury when you violated the law. Anyway, back to this. Above all, he wanted to give praise to every citizen of America for their affection and vigilant support of the Constitution. To every, quote, to every description of citizens, let praise be given, but let them preserve in their affectionate vigilance over that precious depository of American happiness, the Constitution of the United States. Let them cherish it, too, for the sake of those who from every clime are daily seeking a dwelling in our land. People from all over wanted to come here. And when all was said and done, he hoped that we would realize that this insurrection was based upon ignorance and false accusations of government. Quote, and when the calm moments of reflection, they shall have retraced the origin and progress of the insurrection. Let them determine whether it has not been fermented by combinations of men who, careless of consequences, and disregarding the unerring truth that those who rouse cannot always appease a civil convulsion, have disseminated from an ignorance of perversion of facts, suspicions, jealousies, and accusations of the whole government. Excuse me. Now it was time for Congress to amend the laws and make the Militia Act of 1792 permanent. What better and more honorable way was there for Congress to thank the citizens of America than to give the president full and lasting power to call forth the militia to suppress insurrections and repel invasions? Quote, having thus fulfilled the engagement which I took when I entered office, quote, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, close quote, on you gentlemen and by whom you are deputied, I rely for your support. In the arrangement to which the possibility of a similar contingency will naturally draw your attention, it not be forgotten that the militia laws have been exhibited such striking the defects as could not have been supplied by the zeal of our citizens, besides the extraordinary expense and waste, which are not the least of the defects. Every appeal to those laws is attended with a doubt on its success. The devising and establishing of a well-regulated militia would be a genuine source of legislative honor and perfect title to public gratitude. I therefore entertain a hope that the present session will not pass without carrying to its full energy the power of organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and thus providing, in the language of the Constitution, for calling them forth to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. So I cannot underline this whole part of the establishing a well-organized militia. And that language that is used there, that is the Second Amendment. that is the underlying, every person has the responsibility to take up arms to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Because a militia is not just a person who decides to volunteer. That duty falls upon every citizen, that all can be called, period. All must be willing to do that. Excuse me. So in 1795, the Third Congress replaced the original statute with the 1795 Militia Act, which removed or reduced several of the major checks on the presidential's authority to call forth the militia in times of insurrection, Section 2. Among other things, the new act removed the requirement of getting an accident court order and removed the requirement to proclaim a dispersal before the militia is called out. Clearly, our founders envisioned that Congress owned the power to call out the militia, but in 1799, they permanently delegated that power to the president and authorized the president to act decisively, expeditiously, and unilaterally in times of military emergencies. So you want to know where this all came from. You see, people talk about, you know, in 1970s, some of those powers were granted. No. This all started under Washington in thinking that Congress should be able to bypass that. Folks, I'm here to tell you that they should have amended the Constitution to allow that to happen, or we have to basically challenge. And this is where Republic Review comes in. This is where the states need to look and say, should the president, as the executive, be able to grab and call forth a militia when he feels it's to his advantage for whatever reason? No. It requires our representatives to call forth the militia, period, and not to allow that amendment and not to allow these types of unconstitutional laws. Furthermore, Washington met first with the rebels, who assured him the militia was not needed and that he ordered that order be restored. Washington opted to retain the military option until proof of submission was apparent. The large and well-armed militia marched into western Pennsylvania and was met with angry citizens but little violence. When a rebel army didn't appear, the militia rounded up suspected rebels instead. However, the rebellions and instigators had already fled. The militia's prisoners weren't involved in the rebellion. They were marched to Pennsylvania and stood trial regardless. Only two men out of the 24 were found guilty of treason, and both were pardoned by Washington. And so the next part that I have, and I've only got a minute left, is a little overview of the trial of treason, why the Whiskey Rebellion was important. The federal response to the Whiskey Rebellion was widely believed to be the critical test of the federal authority, one that Washington's fledgling government met with success. The whiskey tax that inspired the rebellion remained in effect until 1802 under the leadership of President Thomas Jefferson of the Republican Party, which, like many citizens, opposed Hamilton's Federalist tax policies. The tax was repealed after continuing to be almost impossible to collect. But more importantly, what Washington and what the Congress didn't do when they had the resistance of paying, they didn't create an IRS, they didn't create an ATF, and they didn't give themselves unconstitutional power to go and execute the laws to enforce. What they tried to do was they tried to use the court systems and this local, because they hired local marshals and they hired local, they may have been on the federal employee, but these were local citizens. In other words, they weren't exported people or professional enforcers. These were the sheriffs that they were working with in enforcing the law, upholding the laws of the Constitution. So what they didn't do was they didn't go down the path of tyranny and creating all sorts of unconstitutional government and assuming any laws. This is the most important part. They followed the Constitution as best as they could. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.